This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. This is Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Friday afternoon after a very crazy week in Washington, and we're going to be talking about that today. My goodness, it's been a crazy day in Washington today. For the past few days, uncertainty has loomed for the health care bill. The GOP health care bill has been pulled, though. In case you didn't hear about that, they were actually originally scheduled to vote yesterday, and then they postponed it, and all sorts of talk about, well, what's going on here? And then lots of debate. There was debate this morning as I was driving in. I was listening to some of that debate. It's kind of interesting. And then this afternoon, about mid-afternoon, probably not more than maybe an hour ago, they decided to pull the bill. And we have a couple of potential guests here. This has been moving along so fast that we potentially could have Louis Gohmert, Representative Louis Gohmert, on the broadcast, depending upon whether or not he's able to call in. Of course, you know, with everything going on there in D.C., who knows? Then we have another potential guest, James Antel. He's the politics editor for the Washington Examiner, and our producers are trying to get him on the line right now. Well, then, and in our second segment in New York, we have yet another example of the intolerance of the left, a bus touring the nation, educating about the falsehoods of transgenderism, was vandalized. And Joseph Grabowski with the National Organization for Marriage will be here with the details about that. Our final segment, starting at the bottom of the hour and going on through the balance of the hour today, noted researcher George Barna with the American Culture and Faith Institute has some troubling results from a new survey about the state of Christian evangelism. And while there are definitely some troubling information in that survey, there are also a few silver linings in that dark cloud, particularly with respect to how pastors are viewing the whole situation there. So those are the topics we're going to be talking about, and we are glad to have you along. Let me give you a couple of some important information. FRC.org is the website you want to go to learn more about the Family Research Council. At T. Perkins is Tony's Twitter handle. At Eben Fowler is mine. And I would love to have you get in touch with either one of us if you would like to do that. Well, let's get on to our first topic here. And the way we're going to do that is, first, we're going to open up with an audio clip from Paul Ryan that was heard just a little while ago. But let me set this up a bit. House Republican leaders pulled the GOP health care bill ahead of today's big vote on the measure, and that was just a little while ago, for fear of an epic defeat. And I'd like to have you hear this soundbite from Paul Ryan. Brent, go ahead and roll that.
Moving from an opposition party to a governing party comes with growing pains. And, well, we're feeling those growing pains today. I'm really proud of the bill that we produced. It would make a dramatic improvement in our health care system and provide relief by people hurting under Obamacare. I spoke to the president just a little while ago, and I told him that the best thing I think to do is to pull this bill, and he agreed with that decision.
All right, so that's Paul Ryan just a couple of hours ago, within the last couple of hours, announcing that the big health care bill vote had been pulled. Well, with us now is James Antel, the politics editor for the Washington Examiner. James, this health care bill has been all over the place. What have you been observing? You've been there.
Well, they've had a great deal of difficulty getting consensus, even within the House Republican Conference. You know, on the one hand, they had a number of conservatives in the Freedom Caucus who did not believe that the bill went far enough. They didn't see it as a complete and clean repeal of Obamacare as passed in 2015 when President Obama was still in office. And then you had a number of moderates and Republicans from states where they had done the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare, who felt that the bill didn't go far enough, and or rather went too far. It went too far in cutting benefits to their constituents, and they were hesitant to vote for the bill. So their inability to sort of appease both factions that were holding out ultimately prevented them from getting to the 216 that they needed to get a majority in the House currently.
Well, you know, there has been a lot, you know, if you try to, it's really hard to find a good source of information or news other than, of course, the Washington Examiner. But it's difficult to really know what's going on, you know, what's the what's in the bill. And, of course, it was changing from hour to hour as these negotiations were going back and forth. From your perspective, kind of give us a broad overview of the where the bill stood just before they decided to pull the vote on the thing, in terms of what were the components that you're aware of?
Well, there were a lot of negotiations going on over Medicaid and how quickly the Medicaid expansion mandated by Obamacare was going to be phased out, how much flexibility states would have to run the Medicaid program going forward, and exactly what, how much of the regulations under Obamacare, the insurance mandates, would be on the table to potentially be repealed. The concern was when the bill was originally drafted that the process that they were going to use to pass it through the Senate, it's called reconciliation, that has to be, reconciliation is limited to things that have to do with the budget, taxes, and spending. So they were concerned that they wouldn't be able to repeal the regulations of Obamacare through reconciliation. So most of them were not included in the original draft of the bill. And the Freedom Caucus and some others were pressing for more and more of those regulations and mandated benefits to be on the table to be repealed because they believed it would help bring premiums down and make insurance less costly. But ultimately, they were not able to come up with a package that could get majority support in the House.
Let me ask you this. This is kind of a philosophical question, and it goes back to, you know, really what the Constitution says about health care. I'm not sure there's a whole lot in there.
Right.
But, and I had this conversation with one of our other guests in a previous broadcast. But, the question is really, where in the Constitution does it say the federal government is supposed to be responsible for our health care? And let me ask you a question related to that. And we've gone so far down the road from that in terms of what the citizens' expectations are, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, as to what the government's role should even be. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that clearly was a big problem when trying to draft this bill, was ultimately Republicans were not willing to stand up for the argument that there really isn't a federal constitutional role to provide health care to all Americans. It was a political argument that Republicans believed that they'd lost. So they were basically left arguing with liberals over the details, that liberals were always going to be able to put a more generous-sounding program on the table because they were willing to make a full-throated argument in favor of government control of health care. The argument for reforming health care through just better functioning markets for health care consumers is one that Republicans have not really fully joined or forcefully made. So a lot of the public isn't really familiar with it. And so at that philosophical level, I think that was a real stumbling block for Republicans even before the bill was released.
Well, you know, it's easy to be Santa Claus and to give stuff away, but you know, you kind of get hooked on it like crack addicts get hooked on crack. And when you try to take it away, it's, you know, like, why are you doing this? You know, and it's not something you're entitled to, but it kind of gets to that point to where, you know, it's like kicking whatever habit. It's very difficult to back off when you given when the country is used to being given all this stuff, then it's really hard to take it away. And the party that wants to do that, it becomes a almost unelectable. And that seems to be, and you've just articulated that the Republicans have not had the courage or the wisdom, I would say, perhaps, to explain, you know what, the government's role is not really to give away all this stuff. Instead, let's see what we can do to maybe move back to a more free market kind of a situation where the markets allow us to have affordable health care. Because, you know, the argument that I've heard made is that with Obamacare, in many cases, the premiums have gotten so high and the out-of-pockets, the deductibles have gotten so high that, sure, They'll give you this nice card with the federal government's emblem on it, but it's pretty much worthless. Well, let me ask you, because just before going on the air, I was listening to the front end of Nancy Pelosi's comments. Did you get a chance to hear Pelosi?
No, I did not, though I've seen many Democrats are celebrating the defeat of this bill.
What is your take on that in terms of the, obviously the Democrats have been intransigent. They have not wanted to engage in the debate at all. I'm not necessarily so sure that the Republicans have given them an opportunity. So what's the landscape been in that realm?
Well, it's very difficult because, if you can't really arrive at a consensus among Republicans in the House or in the Senate, it's hard to envision what kind of bill would attract the support of both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, there are obviously some flaws in Obamacare that are affecting consumers, and some of those consumers are represented by Democrats, so that has kept repeal alive politically up to this point. But it's really hard. The parties are so far apart on health care, and to the extent that the Democrats want to fix anything going wrong with Obamacare, they want to move towards something to its left, something more like single payer, which Bernie Sanders ran on in the primaries last year to some effect. So it'd be very difficult. I think the hope a lot of Republicans had is if the problems got bad enough, and perhaps if they had originally followed their repeal and delay plan, forcing there to be something to replace Obamacare, that maybe that would have peeled off some Democrats. But it's really hard to see how that might happen in the current political climate.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate. So in your reporting and in your talking to different members of Congress, and I know you haven't had a whole lot of time because this thing just came down within the last couple of hours, but right. what do you think the path forward is, if there is one?
I think it's going to be more difficult. I think this was the quickest way to get it done, but I think that there were a lot of Republicans who felt that this was a self-imposed deadline and that maybe there shouldn't have been such a hurry and maybe the focus should have been on producing a better bill. And I do think there will still be some efforts to revive this issue. I think that they're continuing premium increases and exit of insurers from many of the state exchanges is going to continue to put pressure to do something about Obamacare. So I don't think this is over, but you do have to wonder if some of the trust between the president and the speaker, the leadership and the Freedom Caucus, whether some of the trust necessary to build those coalitions is there. But I think the political demand for there to be something done about Obamacare is going to continue.
Absolutely. Well, James Antle, the politics editor for the Washington Examiner, really appreciate you jumping on the program here at the last minute. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Coming up next, ironically, vandals spray-painted graffiti and smashed windows on the free speech bus touring the United States. And after the break, Joseph Grabowski with the National Organization for Marriage will share the details. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll have George Barna on to talk about a new survey that he just did that has to do with what evangelicals are doing to help spread the faith, or actually what they're not doing. Well, you're listening to Washington Watch. This is Eben Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for listening.
When governments authorize abortion, do abortions in that country decrease? Many argue that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, as if rarity depends upon safety and legality. We now have nearly a century of evidence documenting what happens when governments authorize abortion. It does not become rare, but increases exponentially. Indeed, in less than 100 years, abortion has become the greatest Holocaust ever, far surpassing all wars and genocide combined. The Abortion Worldwide Report is the first to systematically track reported abortions in 100 nations, territories, and regions from the year of authorization through 2015. The principal authors of the Abortion Worldwide Report are William Robert Johnston and Thomas Jacobson, who compiled the data and information in the report over the last 32 and 14 years, respectively. Their research has revealed that over 1 billion babies have been aborted in 100 nations since 1920. Visit frc.org/university to view this policy discussion.
From Samaritan's Purse and Franklin Graham comes Facing Darkness. In 2014, as the Ebola virus was devastating West Africa,
the numbers of new cases and deaths are still rising.
International relief organization Samaritan's Purse stepped up.
God has called us to care for the dying, to care for those that are suffering.
We can't say we're Samaritan's Purse and not help.
My phone rang. One of our doctors, Kent Brantley, has Ebola.
And then David looked at me and he said, "You too have Ebola."
We're there to save life. We're there in your name. Why?
Despite the fact that things were out of control, we knew that God was in control.
God puts you in places and supplies the strength to deal with.
Jesus Christ didn't run. We run to the fire, we don't run away from it.
Facing Darkness, a true story of faith. In select cinemas for one night only, Thursday, March 30th. For theaters and tickets, go to facingdarknessmovie.com. That's facingdarknessmovie.com.
In the book of Isaiah, the word tells us, "The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever." In the same way, without careful planning, your financial goals could blow away like the seeds of a dandelion. It's never too early or too late to consider how a charitable gift annuity can help you meet the financial goals you've set for your loved ones, your causes, and yourself. Give AFA Foundation a call at 800-326-4543, extension 345, or visit our website, afafoundation.net. Let us explain how a charitable gift annuity can help you achieve your goals. As we read in Proverbs, "The plans of the diligent lead to profit." Our phone number again is 800-326-4543, extension 345. And our website is afafoundation.net.
Washington Watch, listening friends, we appreciate you being here with us. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Well, a bus touring the U.S. educating people about the fallacy of transgenderism was recently vandalized. It's called the Free Speech Bus. And while parked near the United Nations for a scheduled event, two people approached, scratched it with a key, cracked windows with a hammer, and spray-painted slogans such as "Trans Liberation." And by the way, the bus driver was on the bus. He got off to try to intervene and apparently was knocked down by one of these two folks. With us now is Joseph Grabowski. He's the Director of Communications for the National Organization for Marriage. Joseph, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Tell us what the National Organization for Marriage is all about. What do you all do?
Well, we are a national advocacy and education group, and what we do is try to educate the populace about issues related to marriage and family, specifically legal and cultural threats against the institution of family and marriage as the union of a man and a woman. And we also advocate on behalf of those people then in the halls of power, whether it be state legislatures or in Washington, D.C. So we're the only national group dedicated primarily to the issue of defending the sanctity of marriage.
Well, how do you think you're doing? Do you think you've been successful in your efforts?
Well, we had a great success in past years in bringing people to the ballot box and having them vote to amend state constitutions around the country to define marriage throughout the states as the union of a man and a woman. And unfortunately, we all know that with the Obergefell decision at the Supreme Court, that was overturned. However, in the future, those state-level initiatives are still going to remain important if that question of whether or not that decision was decided rightly is revisited, as we hope that it may be revisited once the Supreme Court balance kind of shifts again back to a conservative majority.
Right. Well, we're going to get to this this free speech bus here in just a minute. But I want to ask you, just for the benefit of our listeners, if our listeners, I'm sure many of the our friends who are listening to us right now have had situations where they've had a family member, a friend, a coworker, or somebody, and they've gotten into a conversation about the issue of marriage. Just give us a kind of a quick primer on, if you are challenged person, individually about this issue and somebody says, well, you know, I think anybody should be able to get married. You know, if two people love one another, then why can't they get married? You know, that's the typical line that you hear. Give us kind of a quick enlightening as to how you would respond to something like that.
Well, I would say that marriage, you know, it's not merely a private contract. It's a public good. And this is one of the reasons that the state has an interest in recognizing it and in licensing it in the first place. If the state's only interest in marriage was to stamp a seal of approval on a certain kind of relationship, then I think most of us would agree that the government should be out of the business of marriage altogether. But the state's vested interest in marriage stems from the fact that when a man and woman come together in union, they have the potential to bring new life from that union. And marriage is the best and least, least infringing institution that we have of incentivizing that when they do that, the men and the women stay together, they commit to one another for life, and they commit to any children born of their union. And that has benefits for society, because children who come from stable, loving homes with their own biological parents, they're going to be healthier children, they're going to be happier children, they're not going to be children who become burdens to the state in some ways because of what we've seen, sadly, with the breakdown of marriage and family. It always results in social costs. So I think that that's kind of the best approach without necessarily going into, you know, biblical bases and other things that sometimes people might not agree with in our culture, just to point out to them that if the state is interested in marriage at all, it's because of the unique contours of that relationship between man and wife.
Well, you know, and I was just going to make the point that I didn't hear you say anything in terms of you didn't bring the Bible into it or biblical principles, which are very appropriate when you're talking to someone who identifies as Christian. But, you know, it's very wise that you have an argument that you can do just based on how a marriage impacts our culture and our society. And what you just told us is borne out in the research, is it not?
It absolutely is, yeah. We've seen from the breakdown of the family over the past several generations since the sexual revolution that, unfortunately, when marriages break down, when family breaks down, when you have more and more children being born out of wedlock and raised in single-parent, frequently single-mother homes, that bears social costs. This is why, especially in vulnerable communities, you have so many young men, at least, you know, one time in their life, they're going to spend time in prison. It's because they don't have this stable environment which the marriage-based family provides for their upbringing. So we do think it's a critical thing, and that really it's at the bedrock of our society. Stable families, healthy families, happy homes is what will make a country great, and we need to get back to that.
And you can't really argue against that. Well, you know, we've eaten almost all of our segment up here talking about this, but I think it was important to discuss. And I'm going to ask you to, in about 30 seconds, to give us your thought on the bus, the free speech bus. But first, I want you to make sure you get your website in here so that our listeners can go and actually get the argument that you just presented and get more information about this so they'll be well informed. What's your web address?
Sure. Our web address is nationformarriage.org, and that's the word for, F-O-R.
Okay, nationformarriage.org. You know, folks, take a few minutes to go visit there, find out what the National Organization for Marriage is up to. Okay, so I'm going to give you about 30, 45 seconds here because we're coming up to a hard break. But what's your thought about what happened to your bus in New York City?
Well, unfortunately, we think that this is what happens in a culture that labels those whom people disagree with as bigots and haters, and that's unfortunately the message that a lot of LGBT activists will put out there about those who embrace traditional values about sex and marriage. And we're out there with this bus just simply sending the message that we are made male and female. There are two halves to humanity that are complementary, and the gender isn't a changeable thing. You can't just decide what it is. That's dangerous to teach children otherwise. And so it's not meant to be a confrontational message, but an invitation to discourse. Unfortunately, discourse doesn't mean breaking somebody's windows with a hammer. I think
that's
the
right.
Old expression comes to mind, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
That's right.
I think they know all they have is a hammer.
Well, Joseph Grabowski, Director of Communications for the National Organization for Marriage, thanks so much for taking time to help us understand this issue a bit better. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Well, coming up next, in a troubling new study, an overwhelming majority of Christians don't take responsibility for sharing the gospel or their personal testimony. We'll learn more about that from George Barna coming right up.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, certainly the focus is going to be on the repeal of Obamacare. Is it going to happen? What it's going to look like? How it's going to impact us? How it's going to impact the economy? How it's going to impact the deficit? So on and so forth. Of course, the president's ultimatum, pass it or not, and we're going to move on. So it's going to be interesting to see how things shape up in light of all of that. But look, I like the approach that he took, because the approach is saying to me anyway that he is focused on his number two priority, and that is tax reform, corporate tax reform, individual tax reform. That in and of itself, the notion that he is staying focused on tax reform is going to be good for markets. We need to continue to build upon the consumer confidence and the business confidence, the enthusiasm that has been building since this election. And we have seen a fairly dramatic pause in that optimism and enthusiasm. So hopefully, the idea that we will continue to focus on tax reform is going to be a good thing. That's all the markets are caring about. The downtick and the concern in reference to Obamacare was all about slowing down the legislative process to slow down when we will get to the all-important tax reform.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
You are listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins today in the studios of Bot Radio Network, coming from the heart of the United States of America, Kansas City. And we're glad you're listening today. FRC.org is the website. At T. Perkins is Tony's Twitter handle. At Evan Fowler is mine. We'd love to hear from you. Well, there's been a study done here by a fellow that we know. His name's George Barna. Many of the religious trends in America over the past decade or so are kind of disheartening to Christians. Church attendance is down, profession of faith at low levels compared to the past, resulting in a declining percentage of born-again Christians. The number of people who label themselves as Christians is following. Well, George Barna has recently completed another survey. He's here on the line with us here on Washington Watch. George, thank you for joining us.
Evan, good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you as well. I saw you just a few weeks back at NRB, and I think we were chatting about this survey. Is it the same survey you were telling me about?
Yeah, same survey. The primary focus of that survey, of course, was how many people have a biblical worldview. But that same survey also gave us a range of other pieces of data that we have been releasing, and this is part of that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we have a chance to talk about this piece of it, because it is important. Tell our listeners, if you would, kind of give us a summary of what this part of the study showed. Then we're going to talk a little bit more about it. And then we're going to ask our listeners to call in and talk about it, talk with you about this, and maybe some of their own experiences out there with relation to the issue of sharing faith. So let us know, what is this survey telling us?
Well, in essence, we were taking a look at two different things. One was whether or not people believe that they have a personal responsibility to share their faith in Christ with other people. And then the second piece of that puzzle is, do they actually do it? And we did this study among both the general public as well as theologically conservative Protestant pastors. And what we found was that only about one out of four individuals in the country who call themselves Christians feel they have a personal responsibility to share their faith. We also looked at the data a little bit differently. We had some other questions in there that allowed us to qualify or classify people as born-again Christians based on their theological beliefs, not just calling themselves born again, but actually saying that when they die, they know they'll go to heaven only because they've confessed their sins and accepted Christ as their Savior. We classify those people as born again. In that case, a little bit less than 4 out of 10 of the born-again Christians say that they have some kind of a personal responsibility to share their faith. And then when we looked at whether or not people are doing it, we found that it's pretty similar. Among those who call themselves Christians, less than 1 out of 4 actually share their faith in a given month. And among born-again Christians, again, less than 4 out of 10 will share their faith in a given month. Pastors, theologically conservative pastors, a little bit different. We found that about 7 out of 10 of them say that they have a personal responsibility to share their faith in Christ with others, and about 7 out of 10 will do that in a typical month.
Well, that's at least somewhat encouraging, I would say, is that a majority of the pastors feel like they should, or that they have an obligation. It's called the Great Commission, by the way, in case nobody's ever heard of that. Let me ask you this, because you mentioned that your survey involved, you talked about pastors, but you also talked about the general public. When you talk about the general public, do you mean the general public who define themselves as Christians?
No, all people 18 or older, the entire population of adults.
All right, and then you whittled it down there, and you, as you said, you figured out what among that population would qualify as Christians. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different ways that people think of Christians, so we look at it many different ways. When I talk about people who consider themselves to be Christian, that's the 7 out of 10 adults who, when you ask them about their faith, they say, well, I'm a Christian. But then when I talk about born-again Christians, that's just about 30% of the population, 3 out of 10, who say that when they die, they'll go to heaven because they confess their sins and accepted Christ as their Savior. So those are two very different populations, one within the other, but very different in terms of their perspectives.
Absolutely. Well, now, did your survey ask the question of the people who said they didn't share their faith as to why they didn't share their faith?
No. But we did ask a lot of questions about what these people believe, because you only share what you believe. And that was, to me, even more frightening than the relatively low numbers of people who are actually sharing their faith. I'll be honest with you, Evan, at the end of the survey, after I was done analyzing this, I was actually kind of thankful that not a huge number of people are sharing their faith, because there's so much biblical perspective that gets shared as the quote-unquote gospel. It's no wonder that America is such a mess that it's in spiritually.
That's right. Well, and after the break, I want to ask you to unpeel that onion a little bit and tell us some of the things, because in reading the summary of the survey, you talk about some of the different things that people are actually sharing. I'd like to have you share that. And then also, we're going to have some of our listeners calling in, hopefully. I want to give that phone number right now. Get your pen and paper out. 866-372-7234. 866-372-7234. One of the things I'd like you to think about it before you call in is maybe would like to hear what your experiences are in terms of sharing your faith and why you do, or maybe why you don't, if you'd like to be that transparent with us and tell us that. But we'll be back here in just a couple of minutes. Again, 866-372-7234 with George Barna, the Executive Director of the American Culture and Faith Institute, to learn more about what he found out in this recent bit of research that he did. You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins. We'll look forward to hearing from you. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Whoa, we have not had a response like this before. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We've been doing these spiritual heritage tours for like 20 years. We're sold out for June already, if you can believe that. We've got space left on our September tours of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We call them spiritual heritage tours, and I don't know how long these September seats will last. To what do you attribute that to, someone might ask? Maybe it's the fact that we have a new person occupying the White House. Maybe that has something to do with it. But in any event, we welcome you to come with us on our September Spiritual Heritage Tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Those are two separate trips. You can do both, or you can do one or the other. We'd love to have you. Go to spiritualheritagetours.com. spiritualheritagetours.com.
Is God calling you to pursue theological graduate education? What's keeping you from taking the first step? Is it time? What if you could choose from flexible class options? Is it money? What if competitively priced seminary offered academic scholarships? Do you think you're alone? What if your classmates were just like you, balancing careers and families with seminary? Hello, I'm Dr. John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Take the first step. Visit wbs.edu.
Unwholesome television programs and unnatural social agendas. As believers, we use our religious freedoms to take out the trash in the media and society. Even children's magazines are in the crosshairs. Join 1MillionMoms.com and take action.
This is Monica Cole of 1 Million Moms. We need you to sign up and speak up for our children at 1MillionMoms.com. We are making the difference.
American Family Radio, impacting lives.
Hi, this is Sandra from Bronson, Iowa. I've been listening to AFA for a long time. My life has been a series of difficulties and events because we all live in a broken world. It's the only one we're born into. And I praise God because no matter what hour of the day, I can turn to AFR and hear something that will bless me and help carry me through. And in times when we have our elections, I praise God that you're there to continue giving us the truth. I have a tiny income, but you know, God makes it work. And for everyone listening, I know God is the same for everyone. And God bless all of you there at AFR.
Ensure that we impact even more lives by partnering with us during our three-day share-a-thon starting April 4th. Listener-supported American Family Radio, boldly standing for truth. For your family.
Well, you're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins on this great Friday afternoon. You know, live radio is a whole lot of fun, and going on in the background, you don't even know it, but we may have Louis Gohmert on the line, and George Barna has been so gracious as to let us put him on hold for just a couple of minutes here. If we're able to get to Representative Gohmert on the line, we're going to get a quick assessment from him as to what he's been seeing with regard to the health care bill. That bill, that was the topic that we had the first segment, if you weren't with us. And of course, you know, lots been going on in Washington. That's why Washington Watch is watching what's going on in Washington. So that's where we are. And we have some folks that are holding on the lines. Boy, the lines have just lit up here, and we're going to try to get to as many of those calls as we can. So as soon as my producer lets me know whether or not Representative Gohmert is on the line, we will go to him here in just a second. So I'll tell you what, let's get George Barna back on here if we can. Brent, I'd like to ask George a question. Just let me know when he's ready to go. Okay. George, thank you again so much for letting us bounce around here a little bit today. But I wanted to have you tell our listeners a little bit about some of the findings in terms of the kinds of things that people think they should be sharing that are not biblical. What were some of those?
Well, you know, it's not all bad. I mean, there were some biblical perspectives that folks have about God, but essentially what we're finding is that those who do share their faith with others believe things like the fact that people are basically good, the fact that it's more important that you have some kind of faith than that you have a particular kind of faith. They're more likely to believe that humanity evolved over the course of time. Some of them believe God was involved in that process. Some of them don't believe that. They tend to believe that even though their personal salvation came through Jesus Christ, that people have an alternative path that they could choose, which is being a really good person or doing enough good deeds to convince God that they deserve to be in heaven. Believing that you determine success in life based upon accomplishing your personal goals or leading the kind of lifestyle that brings you happiness or pleasure, believing that because he was not only divine but also fully human, Jesus sinned while he was on earth, and therefore he has some empathy for us as sinners, and also believing that neither Satan nor the Holy Spirit are real, that they're symbols, you know, Satan being a symbol of evil, Holy Spirit being a symbol of God's purity or presence or power, but that they aren't actually living entities that could influence our lives today.
Wow. We have a lot of work to do, don't we? It sounds like. My goodness. Well, we've got a full bank of callers, George. How about taking a couple of calls with me here?
Sure.
All right. Well, Susan is on the line from Tennessee. She wants to talk about sharing faith. Susan, welcome to Washington Watch. Great to have you here.
Hello. Thank you very much. Tony Perkins was in Memphis. I met him with my daughter. This must have been all about 7 years ago or so. However, I do share my faith. I think it is so important for those that know the Lord to have a reason why we believe and to share our faith and share about the cross, and even, if the opportunity allows, to not only give a reason why we believe but invite whoever we're talking to make that decision. Of course, we're not the ones that saved. The Holy Spirit is the one that saved. We are given the opportunity to speak for Christ and put ourselves out there. They're not rejecting us if they don't want to hear. They're rejecting the cross. And many Christians still get are afraid of that because they're afraid of rejection, but it's not us they're rejecting.
Absolutely. Well, Susan, thank you so much, and thanks for being one of those who does share your faith. I just really appreciate that. Well, George, it sounds like we do have Louis Gohmert on the line, but we're going to I want to just give you an opportunity to finish up, wrap up, and kind of give some thoughts in terms of what's important about this survey that you did and how should we as believers think about it.
Well, I'm hoping that the result of this kind of research is that churches will kind of double down on making sure that people have the basics of the Christian faith clear in their minds and hearts. That's first and foremost, because you can't give what you don't have. So we want to make sure that the true gospel is what's being shared. Secondly, the fact that less than one out of every four people who regularly attend church, only about four out of ten born-again people, actually bother to share their faith. That's something else that we can work on. Maybe it's because we don't know other non-Christians. There are a whole range of reasons. But, I mean, that's certainly something that we have to take a look at. The fact that the born-again population is decreasing, the fact that fewer people are going to church, I mean, all of these things should kind of alarm us into a state of greater attentiveness and activity. And if this data contributes to it, that'd be a great thing.
Absolutely. Well, George, thanks again, first of all, for the work that you're doing to reveal this, because then if you don't know you've got a problem, you can't do anything about it. And your research helps to expose these things. And so it helps us to think, well, what can we do? Where do we need where's the lack of education? And we certainly have many, many places that we can go for that information. There are all kinds of organizations that help with evangelism and have done so for many, many years. But we as believers have to take individual responsibility for doing that. So, George, again, thanks so much for your work and for being with us today.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be with you.
All right, George Barna, Executive Director of the American Culture and Faith Institute, talking about his most recent survey. Well, I'm going to take one more quick call from a listener, and then we're going to bring Louis Gohmert on the line here. He'll be ready for us in just a couple of minutes. So, Frank, you're from Kentucky. You want to tell us about witnessing to people? Have just about a minute here.
Yes, I think the church needs to go out in the highways and byways and witness, because I don't see anybody out there. Nobody has to come up to me and ask me in the last 14 years, are you going to hell or do you know Jesus? It's not out there. I think people are actually scared of each other. So that's my minute in the second.
Yeah, I think you're right, Frank, that it's quite frankly, I think all of us maybe, unless except for some of us who maybe just get out there and really enjoy it, it's not an easy thing necessarily to share your faith, especially, you know, with strangers. That's hard. But, you know, even with people that you already have relationships with, it's a difficult thing. But it is something that the Lord wants us to do. And, you know, I'll confess I don't do it nearly enough. Those times when I've had that opportunity to do it, though, it's pretty exciting. And it kind of gets you to the point where you want to do more. So, Frank, thanks so much for calling in and for listening to Washington Watch. Well, on the line with us now, Representative Louis Gohmert, who we were able to track down somehow in Washington. Louis, thanks for joining us this afternoon. How are you?
I've been better, but we're supposed to rejoice in all things. And again, I say rejoice, but I do know there was a time when Jesus looked down at Jerusalem and his heart was broken. He wasn't rejoicing. So there are those times that we rejoice, and there's sometimes we get great sadness. But anyway, today I think it's a bit of a relief that this bill was pulled. Some of my friends were saying, you know, we need to let there go ahead and be a vote so when it goes down, people will know it wasn't just the House Freedom Caucus, the conservatives, that there were as many moderates as there were conservatives that were really concerned about us stepping into the middle of Obamacare that is just a disaster. Premiums are too high. Deductibles too high. People can't afford their medicine. There's so many things that have got to be done, but my goodness, we can't just rush in and have a bill that you got to take it or leave it. But let me tell you, I was so impressed with President Trump, seeing him work behind the scenes the last 3 days, having him seeing him do as much as he did with a bad bill. I can't wait to see the kind of great work he can do with a good bill that he actually helped make sure was a good bill. He got involved in this. He trusted others to do a bill, but this was based on a false premise. We were told we got to just thread the needle and try to get this where it will pass by the parliamentarian in the Senate, and she can't review it until after we pass it. Well, it turns out that wasn't true. I don't know where Paul got that information, but it wasn't true. As Mike Lee, senator from Utah, proved this week, he went to the parliamentarian and said, we're told that these things couldn't get through the Byrd rule and get to the floor. And she said, no, I think they're not fatal at all. But as she knows, and as she said, indicated, I don't make the decision. That decision, whether Pat survived the Byrd rule and was relevant to the budget, would be made by either Mike Pence as president of the Senate or somebody that Mitch McConnell appointed. It would be a Republican, and they can take the advice of the parliamentarian or not take the advice. So the president was told the same thing. Oh, well, this stuff may not get past the Byrd rule. We can't know until after the House passes it. Turns out that wasn't true at all. We can run it down there. We can check the language with the parliamentarian. What do you think about this? If we did this, what advice would you give the sitting president of the Senate at the time? We could get a better feel, and we wouldn't have to be guessing and eliminating very, very important language that most of us really wanted just because we're not sure that the parliamentarian would advise against allowing it in the bill. This was not the way to do legislation. So I am really grateful to President Trump. I tell you, for listeners, when they see and hear him after this thing went down today, you're seeing a really wise leader in the making. I'm so impressed with him, I got to tell you.
Well, now, you mentioned the Byrd rule several times there, and I'll have to admit, I don't know what that is, and I'm sure there might be a couple other folks. Can you give us a simple explanation?
I didn't know either, but boy, you learn when
you learn.
Things are on the line like this. We kept being told it's so complicated. Well, I got a copy. I carried it around this week for the last few days so that anybody had a question, I could pull it out. Basically, in a nutshell, and probably most important word in there is that you're going through this process of reconciliation, if a matter is only incidentally going to affect, and the word is incidental, if it incidentally affects the budget and doesn't materially affect it incidentally, then it will be rejected as extraneous and won't be allowed on the floor. So it has to materially affect the budget. My word, when you're bringing down the massive cost of health insurance, that is a material effect, and those were the things that we were told could not be in the bill. We're going, how could it not be in the bill?
Yeah.
All the burglar requires is materially affect the budget. This will materially affect the budget more than the other stuff in there. Of course it'll survive the burglar. So that's all it is, and it's a tribute they paid to a former member of the KKK, Robert Byrd, that apparently he pushed this idea, and they passed it into law of the Senate. So it is something that had to be considered, but a Republican would decide. And by the way, Evan, what happens if when the president of the Senate, or President Pro Tem, said, This does materially affect the budget, so it stays in. Your objection under the Byrd rule is overruled. Then the Democrat would say, point of order, it violates the Byrd rule. And then the president of the Senate would say, no, it doesn't, overruled. And he says, then I appeal the ruling of the chair. Then a Republican jumps up and says, I move to table the appeal of the chair, and a majority then votes to table it, and it's over.
There we go. And we've got about 2 minutes, Representative Gohmert. I want to ask you just a couple of quick questions and just for some quick answers here. First of all, and you kind of alluded to this early in the conversation, that this, it seems like, you know, why did they need to rush this thing? And they had it originally scheduled for a vote yesterday, and then they postponed it and tried to do it today, and then they pulled the bill. Why in the world did they feel like they had to rush it so fast with something as complex and important as this? They should have given it plenty of time. And then the second question is, were Democrats even asked for their opinions? Not that they necessarily, because they've got a totally different worldview, a different point of view, but were they invited into the process? So just those are two questions, again, about a minute and a half.
Yeah. Taking last first, they were not really allowed into the process. They were treated the way Republicans were treated back when Obamacare passed. This wife said, we don't need your vote, so we don't want your input. And, you know, the president made a very wise statement. I think that we can do this better and get some input from Democrats, and not just Democrats. Have actual input into the writing of the process by Republicans. We still don't know who wrote it. I couldn't help but think that there were some insurance lobbyists that helped write part of that. And they're the ones that signed on to Obamacare that got us in so much trouble in the first place. So it didn't need to pass this quickly without a better writing process. So, yeah, it went through. Everybody was told there'll be no amendments in the committee. You got to vote against anything that's brought. Well, how about letting us put a little Democratic input in there?
Yeah,
it's not
that's
such
right.
a bad thing.
Well,
it
Representative Gohmert,
we're
just about out of time here, and I thank you so much for jumping in here. I know things are going just kind of crazy there in Washington, so it's always good to hear from you. Thank you so much. And I think, you know, the message is I think the people want the representatives, the senators in Washington, D.C., to get in there and work together and do something that's going to work well. So I think that hopefully that message maybe will get through. Hopefully the president can help pull some people together. Anyway, thanks for listening today to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along today. God bless and have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.